Welcome to the Henry Cuenca Radio Show on KKRN Community Radio, licensed in Bella Vista, California, and transmitting from Round Mountain. Here we explore the lives of triumphant humans who endure life's persistent challenges. Our guests are driven by passion and inspiration and live with a compelling sense of purpose. Their persistence, perseverance, are brought on by tragic episodes or by wonderfully cradled lives. But for whatever reasons, guests will openly share their innermost feelings and beliefs that fuel their works. With determination, courage, and insistence, our guests are driven to put more into life than to take out. Please listen to these inspirational, triumphant human stories. And yes, I am Henry Cuenca. To anyone observing the childhood of our guest today, his future path would have been clear. His love of teaching was being foretold as he ran home from third grade each day to teach his sister all he had learned. Then, another pivotal moment during the 1984 Olympic opening ceremonies, as he was captivated by the 84 white pianos playing George Gershwin's Rhapsody in Blue. It was clear from that day that his calling in music was cemented. As he said, "Music or nothing for me." Yes, today's guest, California Department of Education 2016 Teacher of the Year, Mitch Barr, holds one of the most eminent awards one could ever be honored with. Yet, you may find it interesting to know, our guest never knowingly worked towards this acclaim, and his only focus and passion has always laid with the students he felt privileged to teach. His mantra: musicians are unafraid of hard work. We are on a mission together, working side by side. He can often be heard saying, "I don't care what kind of a musician you are. In 20 years, I care about what kind of person you are." Please listen to this heartfelt story. Mitch Barr, welcome to today's show.
Well, thank you, Henry. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, it's a real honor to, I tell you, I will never have another guest like you, being an eminent winner of an award in the state of California for 2016, so it is truly my pleasure to have you as a guest today. And, Mitch, why don't we just start out a little bit. Tell us about your workings at your school. Give us an overview of your works.
Oh, sure. I'm at a school, Foothill High School. It's in Palisadro, California, just east of Redding, California. And I've been there since 2002. The program, when I inherited it, was fledgling.
It was pretty dismal.
It was pretty small.
Was it small?
Frankly, it was kind of the laughing stock of the school. It was not a thing of pride to say you were in the band at all. Uh-huh. And it was definitely something that was kept within those four walls and very rarely let out. I remember in particular going to our first football game. We didn't have a home stadium then. We played at Thompson Field, where Shasta High School plays their games.
Uh-huh.
And I remember walking down the stairs and seeing band kids that already walked down the stairs and turned left completely towards the end zone, about as far away from a crowd as possible. And I turned right and motioned for them to come with me, and we sat right underneath the 50-yard line, right underneath the press box, and played. And that was a very pivotal moment in our school culture.
Did you realize the depletion of the program, where they felt the way that they did? Did you understand that when you took the position over?
No. I knew they were struggling to find a music teacher that would stick there. For whatever reason, whether that was administrative decision or the teacher's decision to leave, I knew they were literally playing band director musical chairs. Mm-hmm. And I know how much that impacts students wanting to continue when you have teacher after teacher mm-hmm. after teacher. So I knew the program wasn't in great shape, but I didn't know the level of hurt that kids, as I got to know them, I started to learn what they had absorbed. But I didn't know that when I took the job.
And you had eight students?
There were eight students in the freshman band. There were about 20, 25 in the advanced band when I took it over. And they didn't want to play. They didn't want to go the first football game. I remember telling them very early on. Yes.
They were.
I remember telling them very early on, I said, if you trust me that I'll never put you in a position where you'll be embarrassed about your performance, we can really do some things. That exact quote came out of my mouth first week or two I was there when I recognized how they didn't even want to play the football game.
Well, I guess another disabling or consideration is the fact that Foothill High School is a very rural school.
Correct. Yeah.
And how did that play into the whole scheme of how you were going to work to turn the whole program around?
You know, some high school teachers, regardless of subject, blame junior high teachers for their lack of preparation. Junior high teachers blame elementary schools. Elementary school teachers blame kindergarten. Kindergarten blames preschool, and preschool blames lack of parenting. There's always someone to blame. And I guess my thought with music education is I can't control what they know when they walk in, but I certainly can control what they start learning when they're in my room. Mm-hmm. And not having certain advantages, not playing your instrument since the second grade or third grade, you can whine about that. You can make that an excuse, or you can just get to work. You can get practicing. And if you have the rest of your life to play music and want to enjoy it, who cares when you started?
Mm-hmm. That's a valid point. So tell me, after that first football game, I mean, your students must have been in a semi-state of what is going on here.
You know, it's a pretty powerful story because it had immediate payoff. We showed up on Monday. We emptied the band trailer back into the room, all the contents from going across town for the game. Literally, we put things in their place and got ready to talk about the game, and the cheerleaders walked in full uniform with cookies for the band. And they were cheering for us, and it was immediate. It was immediate payoff for what we had done. And, you know, some of the best press that you can get is press that other people say for you. Mm-hmm. So I could have gotten in front of them as the adult and gone, I'm so proud of you guys. You did a great job. Right. But to have cheerleaders come in that wanted nothing to do with the band a couple months ago and cheer on the fact that we had this new level of spirit and they were excited for our growth. The band held it together, but as the cheerleaders walked out of giving us cookies and my drum major that had been there 4 years, she just broke down sobbing in that moment. And it was, like I said, it was instant validation that we were on the right path. And my words of like, trust me, I'm not going to put you in an embarrassing situation, had immediate grounding. So it was, you know, if I could go back and thank those cheerleaders, I don't know who they were. Mm-hmm. I had just been on the campus a couple of weeks. But what that did for our program, really.
Well, that was pretty much an instant start.
Yeah, totally.
I mean, an instant start.
I mean, it was probably two, three weeks into the year that all happened, my very first year there.
Must have been a instantaneous gratification. That
the momentum that launched was a date in history that was very important for the music department. That first game Monday morning. Yeah, absolutely.
Did you reach any acclaim with any of the other faculty members or administrators?
People pretty much noticed right away that, you know, there was a buzz. Something was growing.
Uh-huh.
I mean, band kids that are able to admit they play an instrument outside of the band room.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, I started hearing things like, oh, man, I hear great things about what's going on in there. Good job, you know. And I think everybody was very eager to have music as part of the campus tradition. I mean, it had been there, but it just hadn't been there consistently.
Mm-hmm. So I'm going to jump forward just a little bit,
please.
Not too much.
Yeah.
But so you took over this assignment. You had eight freshman students in the freshman band. Your advanced band had 20 or so students, And there maybe are other components of your sphere of work. Give us a comparison as to how things were when you started to where they are right now.
Sure. My largest classes were some acoustic guitar classes when I took the program over in 2012. And I had two classes full of kids that wanted to play guitar. I had a lot of fun with those kids. But as I told them that I was hired to be the band director, I encouraged them, if they enjoyed playing guitar with me for a year, learning how to read music, having fun singing songs and playing songs, to continue their music studies with band, which several of them did. I also had a jazz band that was full of kids that thought they were too good for the concert band and weren't enrolled in that class. So the band students fought with the band students. There was conflict within the actual room of jazz band kids that didn't really know how to play jazz, only choosing to play jazz band. And that was an interesting class to take over and start to train, suppress some egos. By the way, there's some great kids in there that were in both classes that were in concert band and jazz band, of course. Now what the program looks like is I have a jazz band at Foothill. It's chock full of five saxes, four trombones, four trumpets, full rhythm section. I also have a jazz B that meets during the day for that same instrumentation. So I'm, in essence, on my own feeder school. No feeder schools have a jazz band.
Was that
band.
Part of the strategy?
That was part of just the growth of the jazz program and kids wanting it. So I started
it just
that
grew naturally.
12, 13 years ago, and that's blossomed into an outstanding jazz program. When I was trophy chasing a little bit to get a little bling in the room when we first started, there were many festivals we went to where Jazz A won first place and my Jazz B won second place in our division. So it's been a great band also. I have two concert bands. My freshman band, that band one class, has about 50 students in it.
Oh, my goodness sakes.
And my advanced band has right around 70, 75. And then we got to start an orchestra a few years ago. That's in its fourth year. That has about 15 students in it. And is a nice little string program that we got to start. Our administration recognized the growth in the music, and I asked them, I said, there's some string players walking around, and I'd love to be able to offer them an opportunity to play in an orchestra. And so we've had an orchestra going for 4 years. It's been great.
So you have over 120 or 130 students
right around there.
Overall.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Remarkable. What are some of the acclaims that you achieved? I know that you've traveled with your band out of state and different parades. And tell us about your highlights of these trips.
Yeah. You know, I'm conflicted to talk about some of those awards and accolades and stuff like that because – I really believe that band does not exist as as almost like a secondary competitive sport. Like I said, when I first got there, there were some things on the walls and stuff, but I wanted the kids, parents, feeder school kids to walk in and see a little bit of, like I said, bling around the band room. So we did go to some festivals and some parades, and pretty much everything we competed in, we were pretty successful. But about 10 years ago, I decided I wanted to give the kids experience-rich trips and not really worry about competing as much as getting to experience different culture and getting them on a plane, getting them across the country. So we've been going to Chicago and New York and taking
them. They must have been ecstatic.
It was great. It's been one of the greatest things for our program because everything we do with those trips, we all do together as a group. We don't just like go to a theme park and then split off into our friend groups and stuff. We're together for 5 days taking in a city and all its culture.
It sounds as if you teach music like it's a religion or something.
I don't know how to answer that.
Well, that wasn't a question. It was just an observation. But you have put some real things together. Reached out to the community, and the effects of the community has spurred on more recognition and more students and more interest. And tell us about your view. And I'm not sure we're going to have to take a break in a minute or two, in 15 seconds.
Okay.
So I'm going to hold the question.
That sounds like a plan. But
what I'd like to know is the fuel that you inject in your students about the arts.
Sure.
This is Henry Cuenca and the KKRN radio program, 88.5. And we are going to take a short break, so don't go too far, and we'll be back in just a few seconds. If you're just tuning in, this is the Henry Cuenca Radio Show on KKRN 88.5 FM, listener-supported radio. And, of course, I'm Henry Cuenca. And my guest today is Mitch Barr, the California State Teacher of the Year Award. Mitch, we're back.
Yep.
And before the break, I was going to ask you as to the effects of how you touched the community. How that transcended what you did in school to reach out to the community.
Okay. So, let's see. In regards to community, I think the band plays a really strong role in, you know, I think a lot of times what I tell kids is like, look, the football games that we go to, the parades we go to, while there's a lot of band directors that just kind of throw that together last minute, let's get out there and walk around and head out, or they spend too much time focusing on only just like winning the parade.
Mm-hmm.
My thought is those are our largest audiences that we could ever play in front of.
Mm-hmm.
So for us to, from the time we show up and we're getting ready and we're getting lined up to conduct ourselves with pride, to show people what high schoolers can really act like as young adults, to be in attire, to treat people well, to say thank you to policemen that are blocking off the street, to whatever it is, it's our job to show that students that are in the arts serve the community, play with gratitude, conduct themselves the right way.
It's a great philosophy.
Yeah.
Because the reality, art is that.
I guess we're only as relevant as our audience. Like, it's fun to play music, but if you're not playing for someone, what's the point?
Uh-huh.
I mean, you can play for your own edification. That's great. But ultimately, if you're in a band and you have a concert and no one shows up, why are you doing the concert?
How many instruments do you play?
well, I mean, that's not something I count. It's a lot.
Really?
I can.
I know you play the guitar. You mentioned you played the guitar.
Sure, yeah.
And the piano.
Piano, good. If anybody in my rhythm section is absent, I just pick up that instrument and
start
playing.
Oh, you move right in.
So, sure. So if my pianist is gone, or bass player, or guitar, or drums. And then I'm a brass guy, so I'm primarily, you know, anything from trumpet on down to tuba. I can play the woodwind instruments. You don't want to hear me play them for too long, but I know how to play them. Outside of that, yeah, one instrument I love playing at home is the mandolin. And yeah, I took the bongos home this summer from Foothill so I could work on my bongo technique. And I always like having something I fidget with, you know.
Sure.
So yeah.
Sure work.
Yep.
Your passion.
Exactly.
You also work with homeschool children. With homeschool children?
Okay. I do have kids that come in from homeschool to Foothill.
Okay. So you have to go out and prospect or find out where these folks are and get communication to them that they're available to join your school band.
If I don't really go out and seek out homeschool students, if they come to Foothill, I definitely serve them and help them acclimate to a public high school. But no, I don't. I'm sorry. I don't really work with homeschool students.
Okay. Yeah.
I work with kids that come to Foothill to the public high school.
Right. What is your what drives all this?
You know, I guess when I think of hard work, I kind of think back to my upbringing. I think of my dad, who owned a trucking company in town, and long hours and working the trucks and delivering landscape materials around to people. And I saw my mom as a dispatcher working right alongside him. And they taught me the importance of hard work early on.
You washed trucks?
Yep. Washed trucks. Summers worked at a landscape company and with a construction company. And my dad saw I didn't love it and very early on gave me the advice of like, yeah, do something with your brain. Because I didn't like to get my hands dirty. I didn't like to get grease on my hands. And you got 18-wheelers. You're going to get grease on your hands.
Oh, so he had 18-wheelers?
Yeah, he did. And mm-hmm. I wasn't a big fan. I respected what he did, but
sure.
It just wasn't my thing. I'd rather be inside as a kid playing with my Star Wars action figures or playing on the piano.
So you learn hard work from your father. Can you think of an incident or series of incidents that you had that your father embedded into you the idea of working hard?
I think a lot of times, and I think it was his father that embedded a lot of this in him, who owned a quarry down in the Los Altos Hills area, and instilled that into him, into his brother, my uncle. And I remember washing the trucks, and I think any kid that just washed the trucks, there would be a lot of parents that just be proud that they're out there with the brush and the water. And but my dad had a very specific way he wanted me to do things, and it took a lot of time, and I didn't really understand it. And you know, if you're going to take the time to do it right. And, right. You know, a lot of working from the top down, and I would kind of start at the bottom, and that was easier. And, you know, kind of teaching just a lot of ways like that, how to get the grease off things and how to clean things the right way and make that chrome polish. And, you know, I think some of those things, it's like the attention to detail, I think I've carried with me and in the musical world, and certainly several professors I had in college, same kind of thing that instilled in me that, you know, if you're going to do something, like, commit everything you got to it.
You know, my daughter washes my car. So I'm looking forward to that ethic as well as she gets older. Anyway, your mother played a big part in your role. Tell us about your mother.
Oh, wow. So, you know, I mean, as in some ways I feel so thankful that, like, I had a mom that I could come home to every day. The reason for my pause is not wanting to get in too much of a side tangent about how many kids come home and there's no parent at home, right?
Right.
I mean, we just – and a part of that's the economy. We live in an economy where so many parents both have to work. But how fortunate I was that my mom was at home every day when I got home. And so just when you have that as a kid, you don't – I don't think you even realize the amount of even unspoken bonding that goes on from just that – fostering of childhood from a parent that's at home as a kid growing up. But, you know, I can just remember, like, consistent love, just like every day coming home. And, you know, she always had a smile on her face. She was always welcoming to us when we came home. And
took you to Boy Scouts and soccer.
Sure. I presume. Yeah, absolutely. Drove me all over the place. Uh-huh. My sister all over the place, you know.
You have a brother and sister?
No. Myself and my sister. Uh-huh. So I have a younger sister.
Younger sister. Mm-hmm. And what field of work is she in?
Well, she actually gets to be at home with her children.
Oh, good for her. So she's a full-time mom.
Correct.
Oh, that's excellent. What other things did you draw from your father and mother?
Hmm. Well, certainly faith. I was raised in the church, and so I guess I understood early on the importance of being accountable to something greater than yourself. And, you know, whatever beliefs people have, I think it's important that people don't grow up creating their own level of morality with a misunderstanding of how other people think. Or I just think the faith I grew up with, I grew up in a Christian church, and it grounded me to some ways to live that made sense to me.
Mm-hmm. Tell us about your family.
Well, I have been married for 23 years. We got married in 1995. My wife, Carmen, she grew up in Cottonwood, the same little town I grew up in, just south of Anderson. And we didn't know each other.
Uh-huh.
Because there's a little creek that divides Cottonwood. And she grew up on the southern side of Cottonwood Creek. And I was on the northern side. And that happens to be a county line. So it also divides the schools in that little town. Uh-huh. Her best friend, who was the maid of honor in our wedding, grew up just down the block from me. But I never knew her. She spent a lot of time at that house. And so we often think about all the places we were together in that little town or little youth group events throughout Northern California that we were probably there side by side and didn't even know each other.
Oh, isn't that interesting?
Yeah. So I met her at a Bible study that I was running right down the road from Foothill High School, right on Deschutes Road, uh-huh. in my youth pastor's house. And she went to this school. She said, I go to Biola University. And I go, oh, yeah, good school, great. I didn't know what school it was. So I fronted like I did. And then I figured out what school that was. And we started – we had a kind of funny story how we started dating. She worked at a – She worked in a shoe department at Mervyn's department store.
Oh, yeah. I remember Mervyn's.
And so I went there shopping for shoes out of nowhere on a Saturday, and I didn't know she worked there. Uh-huh. So I really wanted to impress her, so I bought two pairs of shoes that day. And so she said made sure I got in the line where she was at the register.
Well, of course. Of course.
And she's writing stuff in the box. And I said, what are you writing there? And we had only casually spoken at a Bible study before. And she goes, well, I'm writing the date and the price, and I'm writing my number. I'm like, oh, yes, give me her number. Awesome. So I get in the car, and I'm driving down to my buddy's house. I'm
what
all confused.
Story.
That was her employee number, though, Henry.
Oh, I see.
So my friend and I, quote, said, you're so pathetic. I'll find a friend that brought her and get a number for you. And so, we went on a date and decided that we wanted to try to commit to a long-distance relationship. And boy, it's just been the best decision I could have made. And so,
oh, good for you.
We have two kids. Actually, kind of a funny story. I guess I'm a little bit of a sentimentalist because I still, in my bag to this day, carry the two labels of the shoes I bought that day.
Oh, my goodness.
These are
sakes.
The two pair of shoes I bought that day. And for some reason, I just decided to hang on to
they're
them.
How old now?
I bought these in 1992.
Oh, my goodness sakes.
And I've just always had these with me all the time.
What are the something. Shoes? What are the shoes?
Let's see. It was a pair. Come on. This is old school. Some of you remember these. L.A. Gear. I bought a pair of L.A. Gear and then I think a pair of Reebok. So, uh-huh. Yep. So, that to me is just one of those God things that led me to a great decision to buy a couple pair of shoes and decide to have a conversation with a girl that ended up being, like I said, one of the best decisions I could have made. So
I read in some of the literature that you gave me that behind every successful band director, there's a successful band director's wife. So it sounds like that's really what you're saying.
Yeah,
she supports your work.
And in that article, I actually did kind of attack that a little bit because, and that is true. I think that the wife kind of being behind the band director and the band director out in front of the community and this wife that works behind the scenes that no one knows, I think that's sometimes a little 1950s in thinking.
Mm-hmm. Could be.
And I like my students to
– I'm from the 30s, so you're not hurting me.
I like my students to know that my wife is a very important part of my life.
I think that's something really to talk about.
And that I never – we kind of told each other early on in marriage, like I will never publicly be at a place where I will – I'm always going to talk her up. She's always going to talk me up. I'm never going to disrespect her in public and vice versa, that we're always going to like – have each other's back. We're truly best friends.
It should be.
Yeah.
It absolutely should be. You had childhood heroes in your younger ages.
Sure,
of course. Right?
Yeah.
Tell us about who your heroes were.
Oh, geez. I mean, as a musician, I'm crossing over to the dark side because I'm also a sports fan. So
we were going to get to that, but that's okay.
Man.
Jump
yeah.
in.
I mean, you say childhood heroes. I say Joe Montana. I say Jerry Rice. Uh-huh. I say Dwight Clark. I say Roger Craig. It's all those 49ers. In that 80s time. And then, it's Luke Skywalker. I was right in that Star Wars era, too. So, mm-hmm. I mean, I was four when that first movie came out. And so that was my childhood.
I presume you went through some 49er football games.
I did.
Yep.
Yeah, I did.
Do you remember a couple years back there were rumors that Joe Montana was going to buy real estate in Palo Cedro?
I did not hear that.
Yeah,
no.
It made local news, and he was buying hot dogs on these road vendors. And apparently he had, as the story goes, or the myth, whatever, he had a distant aunt or something that lived out here in Millville, and he wanted to move up here. So there were Joe Montana sightings, right? My wife was always on the lookout with binoculars for Joe Montana because she liked them too.
So, maybe he's at the 7-Eleven with Elvis. Who knows?
Right. Mitch, we have to take another break right now. So listeners, we're going to be back in a short while. You are listening to the Henry Coinker Radio Show on KKRN, Community Supported Radio. And I, of course, am Henry Coinker, and I'm speaking with Mitch Barr, the California State Teacher of the Year in 2016. I'm very proud to have him as a guest. And, of course, this is the Henry Coinker Show. Mitch, we've talked a little bit about your family and some of your philosophy and some of your grounding and hard work. I know that you were involved in a very, very serious major accident that had a dramatic effect on the course of your life. Can you tell us about that?
Sure. You know, even though I said as a kid, music or nothing with when I was a kid, going through high school, I was also drawn to athletics. And it was the middle of my senior year. Towards the end of my senior year, it was April. I was number one player on the tennis team. I was thinking I was going places with the sport of tennis. And my buddy came and picked me up, and we were heading into town to get fitted for our tuxes or something. It was right around prom time. Mm-hmm. And, you know, single car accident, took his eyes off the road for a second. I was the passenger, and we went into a bridge doing 60, somewhere around
there. That's pretty high speed.
Oh, man, yeah. We had just left my neighborhood. I literally, you know, it was before a car would ding like crazy if you drove half a foot without your seatbelt on. Mm-hmm. So we got out of the little residential neighborhood, and before we pulled on the fast street, I mean, I'd put my seatbelt on 10 seconds, 15 seconds before we crashed. As we really picked up speed there. So thankful for that, for sure. A seatbelt saved my life.
It did literally.
Oh, absolutely. But I was, you know, I was in the passenger seat, and I was leaned forward. I was grabbing a Kleenex. And, you know, I got thrown back pretty bad. Lot of spinal damage from that. I've had a lot of it's been a rough road since then physically.
So you have residual.
Sure. I still feel effects of that to this day. Uh-huh. Yeah.
Well, I know that we don't normally look at silver linings, but I know that I get the feeling that accident really did embed in you some follow-up philosophical aspects about things.
Sure. I mean, I've had the opportunity, obviously. I was 17 at the time. I'm not 17 anymore. I've had the opportunity.
Well, you look pretty young.
I've had the opportunity to really digest the ramifications of, you know, any major event someone has in their life and what that does for them and how you choose to live as a result of that. Mm-hmm. I think it's actually given me a good amount of opportunity for some empathy with students that are going through pain. Mm-hmm. Certainly high schoolers aren't the best drivers on the planet, and you have kids that get into accidents or they're going through things in their life. And it has helped me to, like I said, have a level of compassion towards them. Mm-hmm. It's also, it redirected my life in a different way. I think I was heading in a different place, and I was undefeated my senior year. I thought I was all that in a bag of chips, and I was just really a small fish in a small pond. Mm-hmm. And I, you know, it's kind of one of the dangers of living up here in Northern California. Sometimes you don't get to see all the competition up and down the state or in the country, mm-hmm. and you think you're better than you are. Mm-hmm. So in some weird way, it grounded me whether I wanted to or not, mm-hmm. and brought me some perspective.
Mm-hmm. Well, the accident, they had to use the jaw of life to pry you out of the car.
They did.
And were you conscious during this whole process?
I was told that. I remember I was kind of in and out because I remember them saying, you know, don't move. We're going to get you out of there. I remember that. But the most terrifying thing is I remember I couldn't see. I remember not having
my
vision. Yeah, because I was forward so much and it threw me back so much that it you know, must have been one heck of a concussion. But it knocked out my vision pretty good. So
for what period of time?
I don't remember getting my vision back until I haven't told this story too much. But
well, we want to hear it.
I'm being rolled through the hospital, and you know, I'm still kind of freaking out, and I go to I realize like something's coming back and it's a little blurry, and I look over to the side and this guy's walking by with a Cincinnati Reds baseball hat.
Of course.
Yeah. And I go, oh, they're going to have a good year this year. And I went back out. I remember that. And of course, you know, they had won the World Series, what, in 1990? They swept the A's. So, of course, they were going to have a good year that year. They were defending World Series champions. So,
sure.
I don't know what I was saying. I was barely out of it, but it's funny how, yeah, I still remember that. I still remember, like, looking over and seeing this Reds baseball cap and thinking, oh, a baseball fan, I'm gonna talk to
sure,
this guy.
Absolutely. Why not? How did your friend that was driving the car, how did he endure the process?
I think the certain amount of guilt, right? He's still my best friend. He was best man at my wedding, best man in his. And
Did he have any lingering disability?
He had a certain amount of lingering pain, but he pretty much walked away. Because I was in the forward position, like reaching up, grabbing something, the seatbelt grabbed me so hard. I was in the ICU for quite a bit of time because I bruised my heart. Because the seatbelt just grabs you and rips you back. As if you've been in a car accident, you know. They work.
Well, right.
And so it's a good thing. But, you know, so I think from just the laws of physics and how I was in the car, I just I got more of the brunt of it.
Right. And you're still see physical therapist.
I seek medical attention from time to time. Uh-huh. I'm trying to do what I can to help that. But, yeah, I still regularly do some things to try to help.
What is your greatest personal challenge?
To bring my best every day, every class period. You know, I don't want to – I tell the kids this now, like thinking, okay, I've been in school every single year of my life since I was three. I've never had – the only semester I took off was for major neck surgery in 1991. No, in 1995. So I've been a student or a teacher. I've been in and out of school. And I've had plenty of teachers or professors who've clearly mailed it in or wasted my time. Or, you know, not really – somehow at an early age, I've always paid attention to the art of teaching. I've always noticed teachers teaching, and I feel like I've always kind of understood how much they try to do for their kids.
I know that you were close to your grandparents. Did any of that – roll off on you as to your relationship with your grandparents? I know that you learned to play the piano, or you played piano in their home.
When we went down and visited, yeah, I mean, we didn't see them very much, ironically, but when we did see them, it was great quality time. And I, for some reason, I was closer to them, and it sounds weird, I was closer to them in spirit than I was in proximity. We didn't see each other very much, but when my grandpa spoke, my dad's dad, man, I took that as gospel truth. Mm-hmm. I mean, I can still – we're watching a game, and I can remember it. I can remember, like, being next to him on the couch, and it's the Bengals and the Chargers, Dolphins and Chargers. It wasn't that famous playoff game in the 80s, but it's just, I think, a Monday Night Football game. And I started to – cheer on one of the teams, and he goes, remember, you're Mitchell Barr, and you're a 49er fan. And because he was an original season ticket holder in 1946 at Kezar when they were established. So we had season tickets in our family from the inaugural year.
So systemic.
So there's things like that. Right. Yeah, and so while I didn't see him very often, it's like when my grandfather spoke, it was something where – as a boy, I just, yeah, for somehow I just, you know, I wasn't the kid that went, whatever, Grandpa, you don't know what you're talking about. I just, that was gospel truth at that moment. So
he also was very notable in particular this area at Lake Shasta because
You can still go to up in Mount Shasta at the lodge up there. You can still see a picture of the first ever houseboat that was on Shasta Lake.
And that was your grandfather.
That was my grandfather who had the idea to vacation up to Northern California and probably stick a trailer on some styrofoam.
Yeah, right.
But, you know, like the idea of I want to get this trailer out on that water, and he did. You know, he always found a way to do stuff like that.
So about what? When was that?
Well, my dad talks about coming up here to Redding, and it's why he was drawn here to move the family up when he decided to have a family. So if he was growing up and he was born in 49, we're talking about probably the late 50s, early 60s.
Mm-hmm. Mitch, I want to know, our listeners really would like to know, what makes you good at what you do?
I guess I never stop thinking about the fact that there are kids in every seat that need to know that there are adults that care about them, that care that they do things the right way, that care that they bring their A game every day, and I don't let them off the hook. You know, I was just talking to my freshman today. It was one of the first couple days we've been playing because school just started, and so we were talking about the importance of putting air into our horns because I teach wind band. And I said, because I respect you, there will never be a day where I won't fight you on this. Because it's this constant demanding that they hustle every day. And I'm not going to let them jog. I'm not going to let them walk out that mile. They're going to hustle
every day. Pretty hard line. Compassionate hard line.
Yeah. The expectations need to be set, and I'm going to be fair but firm. But, yeah, I'm going to take a hard line with that because you can't be a wind band if you're not going to generate wind.
Mm-hmm. In the opening, we said that I got a quote from you. I don't care what kind of musician you are in 20 years. I care about what kind of person you are. That's a pretty profound statement.
I've heard so many people that's popped out that they've quoted over the last couple of years since I received this honor. And I'm surprised that it resonates so well with people so deeply with people because – I don't know how to think any different than that. That feels like a very kind of duh statement to me. Mm-hmm.
It's very rich.
Thank you. I guess how I feel is that it's so powerful that the decisions adolescents make during this time of their life define who they're going to be as adults. And that doesn't mean how high your clarinet range is. That means, are you willing to bring it for your family, for your occupation, for your belief system? Are you going to bring that every day in return? And so that speaks to the kind of person that we all hope these young people turn out to be, that there's this residual hope for the future as people watch these generations come up that can be self-sufficient and mm-hmm. and pull themselves by their own bootstraps and you know, be
that's a very worthy, unquestionably worthy statement and belief and practice. I mean, what else would there be?
Mm.
Right?
Right.
I mean, obviously that you've got the combination of a lot of things that you've put together. And it sounds like that is one of the fundamental premises in which you operate. I want to make you a better person.
Yeah.
Right?
I want to help you find the way to learn how to be a better person on your own. I mean, I don't want to be too controlling in that process, but I want kids thinking through that. Who do I want to be as an adult? So much focus is what I want to do as a profession or what job do I want? But who do I want to be? You know, I tell them, and I don't mean to get personal with the kids, but I say, with all due respects to your families, or whether your parents are married or whether they're separated or whatever, if we took the mindset of what kind of spouse do I want to be for my future husband or wife, as opposed to who am I looking for in a husband and wife, mm-hmm. if we looked at it the other way, what can I do to be the best husband or wife for that person I'm going to meet, mm-hmm. I think we'd live in a lot less selfish society.
Mm-hmm.
So I try to get them through music and playing for others and cultivating friendships and relationships through music. I try to get them to start to think that way.
Mm-hmm. My follow-up question is, you've been teaching this success for many years. I'd like to know how many students have ever come back to you after they've graduated and kind of just to meet you and tell you where they are in their stage of life. And I'm not going to let you answer that now because we're going to take another break.
Sounds good.
You are listening to the Henry Cuenca Radio Show on KKRN Community Supported Radio. And I am Henry Cuenca, and I'm speaking with Mitch Baer, the Teacher of the Year in the state of California for 2016. So, Mitch, before the break, I asked how many students, you know, have come back after they've graduated and come back and told you of their life's journey, their experiences, and how and the part that you may have played in their life.
Oh, that's a fun residual of being a teacher with. There is not a teacher on campus that doesn't have a group of students that really appreciate the work of that student or that teacher.
Sure.
So every teacher has a group of students they relate to and that they've helped serve. And I've had those students just like pretty much any teacher. But it is profound. I get to spend 4 years with my students, and that's the benefit of being a music teacher is that they come in as freshmen. I watch them grow from junior high behavior to adult behavior. And I get plenty of kids that come back and talk to me. It's one of the beauties of Facebook. I get that kind of interaction with some former students a lot. Literally, just last night I'm having a conversation with a student that wants to come in, share her story of how music has helped her throughout her 4 years, and she's going to come in sometime this week and talk to the kids. Mm-hmm. That kind of interaction happens many times a year, and I like those alumni coming in a lot because they walk those kids' steps. Like they, you know, they for the current students, I think it's pretty powerful to hear a story of an alumni's journey.
Mm-hmm. Certainly. What do you see in our culture as we are in its present state? What do you see as the cultural missing step of the arts?
Right away, my brain thinks to what the arts teach primarily, which is delayed gratification, and that, you know, I am never going to be the musician I want to be, ever. I mean, part of me is limited in just the level of practice that I have, just because I'm busy waving a stick around and not practicing the trumpet or playing the piano as much as I want to or playing the guitar. So music builds in you this concept that you're on a journey and that you may never fully get there where you want to, but it builds this level of drive and contentment, like kind of working against each other. And it also builds in that, you know, so many school projects you can just kind of knock out that night. You can get your essay done, you can cram for your math test, you can get those history notes copied over. But music, I put songs in front of students that I tell them, I know what you're thinking. You're thinking there's no way I can play this. And, you know, it's that how do you eat an elephant one bite at a time, right? It's
right.
And there's a term with music called woodshedding.
Woodshedding.
And so you and it's kind of based off whittling, which is not a task accomplished quickly. And so you woodshed that passage over and over again, just like you'd whittle down a piece of wood. And there's no shortcuts. You need to practice that slow. And, you know, it's accuracy, then speed, and you need to build that up. And the mind's a beautiful thing. As you train your fingers and your brain the right way and you invest in the process, all of a sudden you look up after a month or two and you're starting to be able to play it and you can get through that passage that you thought, there's no way. And so nothing else in our culture that I can really think of off the top of my head really celebrates delayed gratification like that. We live in such an instant society.
Such an eloquent explanation.
I mean, we live in a world where a 70-year-old man just instantly tweets about something without – you can debate whether he's thinking about that or not. I'm not trying to be political. But, you know, the Twitter universe that we live in, just this instant, let's see what someone's reaction to that, and not even your own thoughts, but just let me see what all these celebrities' reaction is to this and that. I think it's so grounded in the temporal of just like where news is just it's right in front of you and then it's forgotten 10 minutes later.
Precisely.
And I like passing out a song to students that is 150 years old.
Absolutely.
That you go, there's so much time and tradition and history in this. Mm-hmm. And think of all the musicians over the years that have worked on something like this and played it.
Mm-hmm. I just read an interesting thing this morning that one-third of high school students, seniors, have not read a book within the past 12 months.
Wow.
Pretty frightening. Pretty frightening.
That is.
You had, I had said in the opening that you had an aha moment in the 1984 Olympics.
Sure.
Right?
Yes.
And obviously made a big impact in your life and set a dramatic course where
no
you
question.
Were headed.
Yeah.
Tell us about that.
Sure. So 1984 Olympics, I'm born in 73, so I'm an 11-year-old kid sitting on the
– You're good in math.
Sitting on the carpet in Cottonwood with my three channels that I got in Cottonwood watching the Olympic Games in Los Angeles in 1984. And – you know, I can remember the orchestra on the field. I can remember the pianos and they're firing up Rhapsody in Blue and the clarinet comes in and I can remember the pianos playing Rhapsody in Blue and just I had never really seen music on that grand a scale before.
Mm-hmm.
And I just remember being wowed by it, like a kid would be wowed going to Disneyland or watching a huge fireworks extravaganza or meeting Joe Montana or whatever. I just remember literally being wowed by that and feeling aghast and thinking I didn't know music could operate on this level.
Uh-huh. It truly was almost an epiphany, I guess.
Sure, I'm still wowed by the opening ceremonies of most Olympics. Uh-huh. You know, I still Beijing in 2008 with all those Chinese drummers.
Oh, it's
so
remarkable.
What countries show from their culture through music is really powerful.
Absolutely.
London in 2012.
Certainly.
Apparently, I know a lot about the Olympics here. but I think I'm drawn to thinking about those because of my experience with the 23rd Games of the Olympiad. In Los Angeles.
I'm going to take another step back. I could keep stepping back for a long time,
sure.
I'll tell you. But you endured a childhood sickness.
Mm-hmm.
And you were very, very sick.
It's true.
And there was some phenomenal healing mm-hmm. that took place through you.
It's true.
Please tell us that whole experience.
Sure. I mean, of course, I was in my first couple years of life, and I was in and out of the hospital constantly. I looked it up one time. I can't remember what it was, but I was having hundreds of very small infant seizures a day. And so something was wrong with the wiring with my brain. And I was very sick, and my parents didn't think I was going to make it. And I know that it's kind of a story of salvation and faith, too, for my parents. I know my dad, you know, in desperation, I'm sure seeing a kid go through that, you know, ask God for some divine intervention that he could commit his life to God. And shortly thereafter, I was fine.
Miraculous.
Where the doctor said, you know, one of those things where the doctor said, there's really no medical explanation to why you're better.
We're nearing the end of the show. Mitch, what advice could you give parents, students, from all your life's experiences, which have been just absolutely remarkable, what advice would you give folks?
Well, I feel humbled to even answer that because, I mean, you know, you have that moment, and I've had that moment a lot since I've won this award. Like, who am I? I'm a small-town band director. But I guess I would say kind of back to what we talked about at the beginning of the show of encourage your kids to work hard. Encourage your students to dream big, to not be afraid to assert themselves and
follow your
strive
passion.
And have high expectations for what a child can do. Don't look down on them because they're young, or you know, kind of apply some ageism to kids. Ah, kids just being a kid.
Right.
They're just gonna go drink. That's what kids do. Oh, they're just, you know, gonna go make some other bad life decisions. I think we can believe the best of kids and expect that if we set our fair, firm expectations high, they can rise up to those expectations.
Mitch, it's just been wonderful to have you here.
Thanks,
on my
Henry.
Show.
Thank
very,
you.
Very much. I've enjoyed meeting you tremendously. You have been listening to community-supported KKRN 88.5 FM. We are supported by listeners like you and brought to you by volunteers from the community. Are you ready to support your community radio? To become a listener-supported, go to our website, kkrn.org, and click on the donate button, or mail a check to P.O. Box 188, Montgomery Creek, California, 96065. Or you can call us at 530-337-1101 to volunteer at KKRN Community Radio to learn more about us. Thank you for listening to the Henry Cuenca Radio Show, where we are in earnest working to make our community and our world a better place. Please tune in to my show the first and third Tuesday of each month at 8 a.m. Pacific Standard Time, where you will listen to another triumphant human story. I would very much love to hear from you, so please send me an email at Henry, that's H-E-N-R-Y, at kkrn.org, or call me directly at 530-356-9811. Thank you for listening.